Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 21st, 1999. And in the Creekside Room this morning, Marcia Bungie continues from last week the subject of children. And this series is called The Spiritual Life of Children, A Family Affair. Today's tape is 99-6. And now let's go listen in with Marcia.
Go ahead and begin. It's a quarter tell, so I think we'll go ahead and start. My name is Marcia Bungie. I'm associate professor at Valparaiso University in Christ College, which is the Honors College of Valparaiso University. And I teach in theology and a humanities program. And I'm also the director of a project called The Child in Christian Thought. And I've got gathered together about 16 scholars, and we're looking at views of children in the Christian tradition, how we've viewed the nature of children, and also how we viewed our obligations to children, not just the parents' obligations to the children, but also the church and the wider community. So we're hoping that this project will generate a richer kind of theological discussion for our attitudes toward children and our treatment of children today. So while at Holden, I've been kind of looking at several themes around the general theme of children, the family, and faith. We've looked at sin, depravity in children, the vocation of parenting, and now we'll focus on the spiritual life of children, and then later in the week on child advocacy in the church. Well, today I would like to focus on the question, and tomorrow, how can adults help nurture the moral and spiritual life of children? And I'm very interested in this question, not only because my husband and I have our own little five-year-old, and I taught Sunday school for the three-year-olds, and that raised a lot of questions for me, but also because I'm a professor at this church-related college. I'm working with very bright, mainly middle-class, privileged students. They come from all over the United States, and they're doing some very interesting things. And even though I see a lot of promise in these students, and even though I work in this pretty privileged setting, I see signs of trouble among our students. For example, Valparaiso, like every other university or college in the United States, has to really worry a lot about binge drinking and alcoholism. All kinds of policies have been set across this nation to try to address this problem among students. And furthermore, although 90% of my students say that they are Christians and that they come from a Christian background, they've been to Sunday school, and they would call themselves confessing Christians, I'm always surprised to see how very little they know about the Christian faith, about the Christian tradition, even anything much about the Bible, and how hard it is for them to articulate the way their faith is related to their everyday life. Many of my students have told me that they have never spoken with their parents, or very rarely spoken with their parents, about religious issues. One thing that's hard to do when you teach religion in a college is people don't like to talk about religion. It's a very private, subjective thing. So I started doing this little kind of survey for my students, wondering where have they had good discussions about religion? Where has it been? And I was very surprised, and it's consistent, that one of the places where it hasn't been is in their home. So other students, they struggle with their identity. Some are cynical. Some have really given up, are kind of moving toward atheism or trying to look at other religions for guidance. A lot of my colleagues, I don't see it so much among my students, but as a nationwide kind of problem among college students, we see that there's a lot of moral relativism, a kind of I don't care, and this kind of cynicism. And so these kinds of problems, the drinking problems, the lack of understanding about Christianity, and some of these other issues have made me wonder, what has taken place in the lives of these students before they came to college? Who has been nurturing them? What has been taking place in their home in terms of spiritual and moral formation? What role did their parents play in that formation at all? What role does the church play? And then I wonder, too, when you read the statistics about how much we watch television, that it's 27 to 28 hours a week, you know, for children under 18, and for preschoolers, it's 27 hours a week. So they're watching that much television, and you have this slim little Sunday school program, you know, once a week, 1 hour. How is that going to in any way compete with this inundation they have with other kinds of messages? And I was just in the session before this where Wes was talking about how on the average, this is just sounds like an astounding number, but when you think about it, it's probably true, that we see 3,000 kinds of advertisements a day. You know, whether it's billboards, on the radio, in a magazine, on television. And so how in the world are we going to compete in terms of this moral spiritual formation of our children? If you just look at that one little aspect, how much we watch TV. So many in the church are asking, too, these kinds of questions as they see young people drift from the church, or they express moral relativism or cynicism, or know much more about television and movies than they do about the Bible or anything about the church. So I thought just to begin today, we might ask ourselves, and just think about this for a couple minutes before I begin, and I'd like to talk about maybe something like 20, 25 minutes, and then we'll have kind of an open discussion. I'd like to tell you about some views of how to nurture children in the past, and what the particular programs of the Youth and Family Institute at Augsburg College and the Search Institute, what kind of things they are recommending very specifically. But I thought just to get us kind of started to think about this issue, so I wonder, who or what has most influenced your life of faith? And I thought we could just put up some suggestions on the board. So when you think about who or what has most influenced you in terms of your life of faith, what have those things been?
My mother and father.
Okay, mother, father. Maybe that's true for a lot of us. Are there other?
Camp.
What kind of camp?
Youth camp.
Okay. Any other?
Glacier National Park.
Okay, all right.
Travel to the third world.
Okay. Yeah, and a lot of students, a lot of colleges are really emphasizing international programs, partly because it is such an eye-opening experience, those kinds of things. Anything else you'd say?
Sunday school teacher.
Okay. And do you think it was with that teacher? What was it about that teacher that was significant?
Was it? I'm thinking of early age now. Mm-hmm. Okay. But making you feel special, a part of the group, as much as our learnings. I think you wanted to be there.
Uh-huh. So kind of, it was partly the lessons, but partly the way that this person treated you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you might say?
As a child for me, just going with my mother to mission meetings at the church and just sitting beside her and experiencing and hearing all those voices from different teachers and missionaries has a big impact on that.
Okay, so maybe kind of through your mother, kind of being able to experience that wider community and learn something about that wider community while with the mother. Uh-huh. Well, I think we could find some other things that have affected our life of faith, and these are very important ones, I think, common for a lot of us. Merton Strumman, who's been the head of this Search Institute and the Youth and Family Institute, has some real specific responses to what most influences our life of faith. And what he says, and it relates to some of your comments here, is that the best way to nurture faith in children is really mainly through personal relationships and especially through the family. Although he talks about not emphasizing so much in this particular program that they have set up what role the outdoors can play. But kind of your relationships with people and especially the family are those things that most tend to inform our faith. So according to Strumman, he says that the family is the most powerful institution in promoting faith in children and youth. He certainly admits children are influenced by their peer groups, by their congregation, by civic groups, by the school, and by the culture, and certainly not by the family alone. But every level of influence does make an impact on a child's life. But he believes, however, that the primary force in the life of the person is the family, for good or ill sometimes. Although congregations and community and culture are significant, they will remain second to the potential of the family in developing the kind of life that is expressed in the kind of characteristics that we desire for youth. Now, so he would like to see us think of the family as the backbone of this nurturing of faith in children, and see the church sort of working with the family, certainly, and being a resource. But the problem is, he thinks that right today we tend to see the church as the place where you get spiritual nurture, and sort of you go then to Sunday school, and that's where you get the spiritual nurture, where he'd like to sort of turn it around and say that, no, it's got to be the family that's going to be the backbone. He says congregations too have kind of erred in allowing the focus of faith development to shift away from the family to become more centered on the congregation instead of the family. And he says, for these reasons, you might have kids going to Sunday school all the time, but if there isn't that kind of reinforcement in the family, they're not going to really pick it up. And especially when you think about that television statistic, I think, you know, how in the world is that 1 hour a week going to compete with the 27 hours unless it's sort of reinforced in sort of a daily way through your daily routines? He says that very few families even have dinner together. You know, so how are they even communicating this, let alone having devotions or talking about faith? Very few of them even have dinner together to talk about matters that concern them. And that's what my students have said to me as well. They say that, you know, they've all got different schedules. It's kind of rare that we come together for dinner. And that's why there really aren't occasions when they hear about what their parents are thinking about and their parents' attitudes and convictions. Now, the idea that the family is central in spiritual formation of children and young people isn't a new idea. Emphasis on the formation of faith in children is found within the Bible and throughout the Christian tradition. And I'd like to take just a few moments to just give you a few examples of this to kind of give you a historical perspective to Strumman's remarks, and then I'd like to focus real specifically on his program. Certainly, if you look at the Old Testament, Walter Brueggemann, this wonderful Old Testament scholar, has said that in the world of biblical faith, the family is the primary unit of meaning that shapes and defines reality. And if you look at Jewish practice today, Jewish practice still expresses the centrality of the home and the faith formation of children. For example, feasts and holy days are often celebrated kind of around the altar of the family table. That's where those rituals take place, much more than emphasis in the synagogue. Or in the early church, if you look at the New Testament, we see that, how did the church grow? It grew from household to household. Paul would go to the synagogue, a lot of times he'd get kicked out, and then he'd go into these households, and that's really how it caught on, through these personal relationships. John Chrysostom, who's a very important 4th century theologian, he's still very important for the Orthodox Church today. He lived in a time when monasticism was highly prized. Monasticism was really growing in the 4th century, and people tended to see that as the way to devote your life to God. But he very clearly said, no, parenting is a sacred calling, it is a sacred vocation, and we have to lift up this vocation of parenting. And he says what their duty is really to help restore the image of God, that we're all made in the image of God, but somehow that's been defaced. And so what's our goal and what's our task as parents is to help restore that image, working with God to help restore that image in children. So he likens parents to artists who are making wonderful paintings and statues for the king. He says that we have to work with precision with these children so that they become beautiful paintings and statues for the glory of God. He also likens the task of parenting to a Christ's action. He says that parents are certainly not saviors of their children, but they are their natural teachers, just as Christ was the teacher of all humankind, and how Christ was kind of a prototype of the image of God. We are to be Christ, to sort of show that image of God to our children as parents. He also says that the family is really a microcosm of the church, and this is theme that comes up a lot in the history of the tradition, that the family is a little church or a microcosm of the church. It's a sort of sacred place where faith formation takes place. We certainly see this emphasis on the family in Luther. Luther also lifted up the vocation of parenting. He says mothers and fathers are, and this is his exact quote, they are apostles, bishops, and priests to their children, because they make children acquainted with the gospel. So that's how important that vocation of parenting is. And he thought the home is the foundational place for passing on that faith. He provided a lot of guidance for parents on how to discipline their children and to nurture the life, faith life of children in the home. He wrote catechisms, which he thought should be used in the home by the parents as a way to help teach the faith. And he wanted parents to read the Bible with children, to teach the catechism, to pray together on a daily basis. And it's kind of interesting because that's a little bit of a paradox you find in Luther's work, because his theology says so much, hey, it's God's grace, it's God's word, it's God's the Spirit. That's what's working in you to generate faith in you, the word, the Spirit, and God's action, God's grace. But on the other hand, he and all the reformers, they spoke a lot about how you got to work hard to nurture faith in your kids. And this was a tremendous period for speaking about the role of parenting in the formation of faith. So I like this quote from Gerald Strauss, who says that only in Luther's formal theology was a sharp and final distinction made between human effort and divine grace. In practice, Luther and his followers were convinced that a systematic program of religious and ethical indoctrination would have results. They believed that right thinking, right believing, right living people were in large part the products of disciplined, hard human work. So I like to lift up that kind of paradox in Luther. And just a couple last examples come from the 19th century. One is the theologian Schleiermacher. He has been called the father of modern theology. He's a very important Reformed theologian, the most important between Calvin and the Reformation and then Barth in the 20th century. And he argues that the Christian home is the first and irreplaceable school of faith. He says only in the Christian home children can actually experience the full range of Christian religious affections. So he talked a lot about Christian religious affections and come to a living faith in Christ. And he, like Luther, very much emphasized, you got to read the Bible together, you got to pray. That's really a basic part of what you should be doing as a family. And then finally, Bushnell, another 19th century theologian. He was a congregational pastor and scholar, and we talk about him as kind of the quintessential American theologian on childhood. He wrote this book, Christian Nurture, and was kind of a bestseller in his time. And he, like Chrysostom, spoke about families as little churches. Although he saw a certainly important role of the church in the faith development of children, he believed the primary agent of grace was the family and not the church. And here's a quote from Bushnell. He says, "Religion never thoroughly penetrates life until it becomes domestic." So religion is never going to thoroughly penetrate life until it becomes domestic. He believed Christian nurture took its deepest root in daily routines of faith, family faith, kind of hour by hour, year by year, as the child absorbs the Christian atmosphere of the home and observes the example of parents. He emphasized very much the heroic nature of little things in life. I love this quote. He says, "It requires less piety to be a martyr for Christ than it does to maintain a perfect and guileless integrity in the common transactions of life." So it's, you know, easy to go out there and do great things and really have integrity in those day-to-day, hour-by-hour activities. That's where we need to sort of reflect Christ in our lives, he thought. So there's a long history of this idea that parents and the household are significant. They play a tremendously significant role in the faith development of children. And nevertheless, today, I do think, like Stroman, that we are tempted to see that the church is the place where we want our children to be nurtured spiritually. You get a lot of baby boomers coming back to the church, partly because they say, well, I want my kid to have some sort of spiritual moral formation. Well, that's very, very good, and you want some help with the church, but you need to see that it's got to be a vital partnership between the church and the home. So now I'd like to look carefully at some of the central points that Stroman makes about the faith and the development of children. I think you'll have to share these. So maybe, one every two people could just share. Because I outlined some of his characteristics of faith in children. And I'd like to just go over this briefly. And then we'll have a chance to talk about his ideas and your own about what best nurtures the spiritual and moral life of children. Did everybody get at least be able to see one? We'll wait just a second here. I put kind of Stroman's major claim on the top that the family is this most important institution in promoting faith in children, and he really wants congregations to stop thinking they have the responsibility and help give it back to the parents and to the home. And what he does, he's done a lot of studies for the last 40 years about children, and again, we can talk about his work after we look at it, but he has some very good ideas, I think. He starts out by listing characteristics of evidence of living faith in the youth. And we might disagree about some of these characteristics, but I wanted to just put them down so you see what he's working with. In his studies, he lists these 10 characteristics as evidence of a living Christian faith and moral maturity in basically high school students. So one, he's talking about that they know a personal Christ. Two, there is evidence that they're leading unprejudiced, loving lives. Three, they commune regularly with God, mainly through prayer. Four, their lives reflect self-esteem. Five, they are morally responsible. Six, they accept authority and responsibility. Seven, they identify with the congregation. Eight, they hold positive attitudes about themselves and about the world around them. Nine, they understand grace. And 10, they are mission and service oriented. Now, again, we might debate this, but basically saying, what are the good characteristics we might say we would see in mature, responsible children who we'd say have had a rich moral and spiritual kind of formation? And those are his characteristics, and maybe we'll come back to this a little bit later, and we might agree or disagree with what he says here. But based on what he's working with, what he's saying, I want to find, what's he saying then is going to help nurture this? And basically, he's talking here about probability. He's very much a Lutheran. He believes in God's action, God's work, and he's saying, this isn't a guarantee, but it's kind of a probability. We were speaking yesterday a little bit about the difference between Luther and Chrysostom, because Chrysostom basically said, hey, you are going to be judged by the virtue of your children. It's going to come down to what your kids are like. Whereas Luther, he's a little more open. He's like, well, you do the best you can. Might not work out, but try. And Stroman's a little more in this area, too. He said, this is the probability. But what could help us? What can families do? And he has some good ideas. He says we kind of need to rethink the way we think about families. And we need to start seeing families as like a sacred community, or again, this domestic church or a little church. Start re-envisioning how we think about what the family is, or how we think about parenting, that parenting is a sacred calling, not just you got the kids and you've got your real career over here, but and parenting is kind of on the side. I also could have added here, we might rethink the way we think about children. Maybe if we start thinking more about children as gifts of God, or as made in the image of God, as vehicles even of revelation, and I'll say a little more about that later. That is also kind of a nice way to sort of nurture what he's trying to say here in terms of what families can do. Well, he says, we've got to remember that God requires two things for families. First, that you've got to have close family relationships, mutual love and respect between all members of the family. And here he's building on Ephesians 6, 2 to 4, where the children are to honor the mother and father, and that the fathers are not to provoke anger in their children. They're supposed to be kind of a mutual love and respect in the family. And then you need to nurture a close relationship to God, building on Matthew 6, 33 that says, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." So then he outlines these 8 assets or contributors to close family relationships and close relationships to God. And I'll go through very briefly the first 4 close family relations, because I think this is very much related to things you would read in Brazelton, the famous pediatrician, or Penelope Leach. These are things you read in a lot of secular literature, too, just about how you raise kids. And one is you've got to have parental harmony. This, he said, according to Strumman, is the best predictor out of 39 possibilities of a sense of family unity, is that the parents have some kind of harmony. Effective communication. If this is lacking between husband and wife, it's probably going to be lacking between the parents and the children. And this is an interesting thing he says. He says that these patterns must be set early in life, well before the child enters 5th grade. So he kind of sees that 5th grade is it. If you haven't got it down by 5th grade, it's kind of a lost cause, because after 5th grade, children really lose a lot of interest in trying to communicate with their parents. And I thought that tragedy in Littleton, if you were listening to some of the panels they had with young people, it was very interesting how often they said, "I don't speak much with my parents," or "They don't listen to me, we don't have conversations." They want conversations, but they really aren't feel that they aren't communicating well with their parents, and they wanted that. The third is wise parental control, and this you'll see in the, you know, literature on child rearing all the time, where you want a kind of authoritative but not an authoritarian or permissive kind of way of disciplining children. Authoritarian parents set limits and expectations, but they are also flexible and loving. That's the kind of sense of authoritative type of parent. Parents who exercise authoritarian control with very rigid rules, harsh words, cruel punishment, can expect to see their children involved in rebellious and at-risk kind of activities. Parents who are permissive can expect to see children with little sense of responsibility or self-control or an ability to delay gratification, which all this literature, you know, talks about the importance of children being able to delay gratification. And then finally, parental nurturing. You've got to create a positive emotional bond with the parent and the child, and to be emotionally available to your children and provide a lot of care and support. So those are the contributors that will help build a close family. And I want to say just a little bit more about those that contribute to a close relation to God, because this relates a little bit more to that spiritual nurture. First, he would say you need gospel-oriented parents. Well, what does that mean? For him, it means 2 things, basically, that the parents are believers themselves and that they live out the Christian faith in ways that love and serve others. So they're providing a very good example of a believing, but also a very active Christian who's out there in some way showing service to other people. As one program says on children, if congregations want spiritual children, they need spiritual adults, because faith is caught more than it is taught. I like this Thurgood Marshall. He talked about how you kind of catch faith like you catch the measles or something. It's by contagion. It's not by indoctrination. So that's one emphasis, being a good example. And a second thing, he means that they are biblically oriented, that they see the Bible somehow as still central to their life. The second important factor is communicating moral values. And he would say, like many other people, that moral values are most powerfully communicated to children by the parents. They are the primary influence in shaping the moral values of their children. And children will more likely accept the values of their parents if there's a climate of love and genuine concern and empathy and compassion. Now the third one is a little bit striking, and I've put an asterisk beside the next 4. It's 3, and then 4 has 3 sort of points related to it, because the Search Institute and this Youth and Family Institute would say these are the key factors to nurturing faith in children, these 4. So I want to say just a little bit about those. The first, involvement in service projects. They say it's very important that children do something for other people with their parents. Do some kind of service to other people. Now, this can be very informal. It can be helping somebody, your neighbor who has cancer, and you're taking meals to that person, and the child is helping you make that meal and taking it over to that person. Or it can be something more formal, like you're going to be involved in Habitat for Humanity. But this is a very significant, one of their key kind of factors, they think, in nurturing the spiritual moral life of children. According to two studies, involvement in service proved to be a better predictor of faith maturity in the ways that he's defined than participation in Sunday school or Bible study or worship services. So this is a tremendously significant thing to see you with your parents trying to do some kind of service project for others.
And I found that as an adult.
Yeah.
That's the place, as you talk about what is most important in my life.
Right.
Is service in community.
Yeah. And if you come to these, you know, they have these staff meetings here Wednesday night at 7. And it's so powerful. You know, you can sneak in if you're not on the staff, but just sneak in and listen. Because they always have these goodbyes to people who've been here. And the testimonies they give through the personal relationships they've had through some service project together or being here together is really a wonderful kind of testimony to what you're saying. Now then the next point is the sharing the faith in the home. And there's three aspects to sharing the faith in the home. The first is caring conversation. Okay, what do they mean by that? Basically, they're saying you've got to speak frequently with your children about faith and other important issues in their life. Basically, it means listening to your children, their concerns, their hurts, their joys, their dreams, their visions, and then telling children about your own faith and your own convictions. And children want this. According to one recent study, 75% of youth want more time to talk with their parents. That's quite a statement. It was really so revealing in that Littleton thing, I think, because of all those panels, consistently the ones I listened to, not necessarily the children in Littleton, but, you know, youth talking about their issues. They want to talk to their parents. So they want to hear about what we value. And this Marion Wright Edelman, the head of the Children's Defense Fund, a powerful advocate for children, a wonderful woman, she says too, this is crucial that children have time to talk with you about things. Or hear the, like you were talking about, when you went with your mother to that community, you think you'd go to the church and hear what other people are thinking and hear what the other people in your community are saying about themselves. I think that's so important. They pick up a lot from that kind of conversation, just listening to that kind of conversation. We have a young child, and my friends, my age, we've kind of gotten into a bad habit that we've all tried to break now. And that is you go to dinner parties, and you have your kids there, little kids, and they're noisy. They're noisy little kids. And you want to talk. And so a lot of people, you get out the video. Because then you say, let's take the kids, they can have their meal and watch the movie, and we'll talk over here. But what they're missing is, and I remember this from my own childhood too, sitting there at the dinner, and you're kind of, you know, waiting there. Everybody else is still eating, and you're finished, you want to get up. But you heard about what your Uncle Fred thinks, what, you know, your Aunt Elma thinks, and you started to learn, what's my family thinking about? How do they see themselves? This is very important. And it sounds so simple, doesn't it? But it's very difficult because people have busy schedules. They either are not making time or they don't want to make time. Again, the children are watching 27, 28 hours of TV a week. They said, there was another study that said parents too, they spend about 50% of their time, their leisure time, watching TV. This is just a tremendous amount of time. Whether you want to agree or not that the television is a bad influence or a good influence, if you just say, gee, look at how much time we're spending with it, instead of doing some other things like talking to one another. According to one recent study, and I still can't believe this, but here it is, fathers spend only 15 to 30 minutes a week in conversation with their children, and that is, it's mostly instructions. You know, go get your toothbrush, go do that, go do this. I don't know. That sounds extreme, but I've read that in a couple books. So we need to be more intentional. We need to try to carve out this time, and maybe we can brainstorm together about what you do at home. Devotions. What does devotions mean? That's the next kind of key factor. It means focus on the Word of God mainly and prayer. It's strengthening your spiritual life through some kind of exposure to the Word of God. This can mean, of course, reading and studying the Bible. And Luther had a nice way of saying, how do you do that in the home? How do you get together? You don't feel quite comfortable with the Bible. What do? We said, it's nice to ask just four questions. You read a passage, and then you ask, what did you learn from it? And just try to brainstorm about that. And then your next question you ask is, what do you want to thank God about in relation to this passage? Is there anything you want to thank God about? And then the third thing is, what does the passage remind you of, what you have neglected or what you regret? Is there something in the passage about that? And then the last one is just, what do you want to lift up in your prayers that came out of this passage? So that's kind of maybe a simple way to begin. He also certainly recommended helping teach the catechism to children. But it can be other things. You can do it through singing, maybe through some kind of meditation. There's lots of ways to kind of strengthen the daily life through some kind of exposure to the Word and through prayer. Although here, again, one of the obstacles is parents feel kind of ill-equipped. They say, I don't know much about the Bible. I don't know what I'm going to teach my kids. And, you know, somebody else should be doing this because I don't know much myself. But we need to think about ways we can begin simply, all of us in our homes. The final one is rituals and traditions. These are patterns of behavior done on a routine basis that communicate or reflect aspects of our faith. So it could be something daily, something weekly, something yearly. My colleague Dorothy Bass has written a beautiful book about practices, religious practices, and now she's just coming out with a book that focuses on things we can do daily, weekly, and yearly that promote and foster faith in the family. It could be something daily, something very simple, lighting a candle as you pray or read the scripture. It could be a greeting in the morning, the way you greet one another in the morning, you know, instead of saying, get out of bed, come on, we gotta go. Just maybe some other thing like, this is the day the Lord has made, let's rejoice, be glad. It's something else to greet the day or in the evening. Luther recommended beginning and ending the day making the sign of the cross as a kind of remembrance of the baptism. Yearly rituals, of course, can be focused around the seasons of the church year. You can do special foods, special kinds of singing around Easter or Christmas or the around Lent. Maybe you could pick as a family something you'd like to do together to focus on Lent.
Baptism and anniversary.
Right, exactly. That's a very good thing. Thinking about baptism anniversaries or milestones or remembering things in the history of your family. Maybe even remembrance of a death or a birth or a baptism.
I have a neighbor. This is a neighbor who goes to breakfast to the same restaurant every single day, and for him, that's a religious experience.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it doesn't fit into the context of faith language, but when he said that, I could really connect with that.
Yeah.
Because I'm that kind of person too. I don't have that, but
yeah.
When he said that, I thought, I want to do that.
Yeah. Well, that's very good. You know, and I think it points out the importance of rituals in our lives. We do have these rituals. We get up. Some of us like a little coffee and read the paper. We like shaping the day around certain rituals. And so to try to interweave in that daily life something that reflects or nourishes faith, that would be something that would be important to do. So this is the four keys that they're emphasizing in this Youth and Family Institute. I think it's very important to remember that children are picking up values and beliefs, whether we like it or not. They're going to pick up something somewhere, and they're not going to just be vacuums until we come to them and say, this is what I think. And so the question is not whether children will be formed morally or spiritually, because they will, but rather what kind of spiritual and moral formation will they receive. And so spiritual formation demands a choice on our part and an intentionality and an awareness, because we all think, I think, need to become more intentional helping to shape the lives of children around us. Now I just want to end with a couple qualifications or reminders. One is that this emphasis on the family certainly means that churches still play an important role. This Youth Institute really wants a vital partnership between the church and the family. They want ways that the church can equip parents to do a better job in the home. Also, these guidelines, I think, aren't just for parents. They're for anybody who has an interest in children. And they're, you know, having an important conversation with a child is a very, very important thing. The number five thing, I mentioned the four keys, but number five, they didn't list it as a key, but another very influential thing is just having some adult other than your parents who speaks to you kind of on a regular basis about faith and life issues. That is significant in terms of what influences your faith life. One other reminder, I think we have to remember too that some parents aren't doing a very good job raising their children, and that we think we have to really take a concern for all the children in our midst, not just our own biological or adopted children. And that certainly a focus on the family doesn't mean a kind of family idolatry. I love the sermon that Maya gave last night where she talked about that. So that's not their intention, but just lifting up the importance of the home as a spiritual place, as a sacred place where we nurture faith. I also want to say that we need to recognize children help shape the moral and spiritual lives of adults. That we have been focusing here on the suggestions for parents, what they can do for their children. But, you know, the New Testament says children are also vehicles of revelation. And I think these practices and suggestions, although they're focused on what parents can do for children, can also help us be more open to what children can teach us spiritually and morally. Now, I gave just a couple examples on the bottom there. The Child in Our Hands, I have a lot of resources here. They're trying to focus on those four keys I mentioned. They also have a program that focuses on 13 milestones in a child's life and how you can celebrate that in the home and in the church. They have a wonderful, just wonderful resources. And I brought some catalogs from the Youth and Family Institute. I brought their mission statement and this leadership manual on the Child in Our Hands, which is sort of the overarching theme of a lot of programs that they have for trying to create a more vital relationship between the home and the family. Also, I just wanted to mention this family-centered catechesis, which was a religious program started in Texas by this woman, Marjorie Thompson. And she has written a very nice book called Family, the Forming Center. It lifts up a lot of the themes here and gives some very nice suggestions how you can do this, carry this out in the home. And she started this program where she said, hey, we got to give the job mainly to the parents. And so the church is going to help you, but it's mainly your job to do the moral and spiritual formation of your kids. And she got a lot of resistance. Some people even left the church. They said, I don't know anything about the faith. I don't know anything about the Bible. I don't want to do this. You are the people. We hired you. We're paying you. You do it for our kids. And but anyway, they persisted. I don't know how she got the backing, but anyway, people laughed. It was terrible, you know. But she started this in 1991, and there were 700 families in the parish. But just 7 years later, there were 2,400 families in the church, with 65% of their members under 35 years. Because parents all of a sudden found it so exciting, because they said, I'm learning so much about my own faith, and we're doing this together. It's really helping our family. We feel a lot more unity in our family. So it's been a tremendously successful program. Parents are highly enthusiastic about it. So I really like that book, and you can look at that afterwards. I also, just as a resource afterwards, maybe you want to pick this up, I have a selected bibliography on books about children, the family, and faith. A lot of different kinds of resources. Well, maybe I thought we have a lot of things we could talk about, but I thought maybe we might focus on, you know, what suggestions you have to, you know, kind of working with those four keys in your family. Or again, this isn't just for parents. I think it's for grandparents, it's for aunts and uncles, it's for anybody who has contact with children. We might also talk about what the obstacles are that prevent us from practicing these things in the home, whether it's obstacles in the church or our own family life or from the culture, and how the church might help best help families nurture faith. So those are some of the questions, but maybe we can comment on any of those. Yeah.
You just mentioned, I guess we call it obstacles, is so powerful, and that's
kind of, I think, for lack of a better expression, kind of the myth of the expert that we have in our society that stops all of us from thinking we can't do it because I don't have a degree in it.
Yeah.
And especially with issues around religion. You know, I have an MDiv, but the most I've learned about faith is from my mother talking about how her faith impacted decisions and things that happened in her life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she was never shy about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just, there's so many people who don't even feel like they know how to read the Bible.
Yeah.
And as pastors, we'd love to happen.
Yeah. You know? That's very good. I think that's very good. And that's what this Marjorie Thompson was really just fighting so much. Nobody wanted to do this. They said, you gotta do it. I think also kind of related to that is we think about religion as very private.
Mm-hmm.
And so private, you don't even talk about it with your parents. It's very subjective. It's just what you think. So it's not as sort of open for discussion. That's a very good point. Are there other...
Along that same thing, there... two other single women, along with myself and my Catholic parish in Portland, we were sitting around the table trying to figure out how we could address some of the issues with the young people, because we were doing we're responsible for youth education. And it was basically, why are three single women so worried about the religious education of the kids in this very small parish? Where are the parents? And part of the obstacle of the parents is being so tired.
Mm-hmm.
Because the schedules of uh-huh. their kids are so busy that in some ways they have out and out said to us that it really is nice having someone else who cares about this to do it when we don't have a lot of time and we're so tired and we don't have the ideas and all of that kind of
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of it is just the pace of life people keep themselves mm-hmm. at too.
Yeah.
Even though they really want to be engaged, they sort of have kind of left it go by the wayside.
So. Yeah. And I think that's kind of related to maybe we need to think our view of parents. Because like, okay, let's just take Luther's example. He says, what's your job? It's your to nurture faith. And the other job is to help develop the gifts of your children so they can serve others. Okay, so it's related to service. I can't get this to right. But you help develop the gifts of your kid. So if you think about that, if you had that really in mind, maybe you'd do something else. Or maybe you'd switch your job. Maybe you'd buy a smaller home. Maybe you'd do something. Because you said, gosh, I don't have even any time to do what I think is important. We certainly, I don't know, but it's hard because people do have a lot of economic concerns, but sometimes maybe we need to rethink. If we're so tired, we can't do it. A lot of people say too, I'm so tired, I come home, I just turn on the TV so the kid can eat, watch TV while I make the dinner, and boy, they need dinner, that's time for bed. That's it. That's the rest, that's the day you had. So I think that's a very important point. Does anyone else want to mention other obstacles or get into another area?
Well, I was just thinking that we need to be reminded as a community that we make a commitment at a child's baptism to support the family and help with the bringing the faith along for each child.
Right.
And to do that in a way that
right.
we are called, recalled to that commitment.
Yeah.
It's been helpful for us in a recent program we're developing Wednesday evening is to make it easier for families who are tired, parents who are tired, that the parents come with the child and we sing together and we do a little thing together and we make the meal and they eat together and then we play together. So to help support that difficulty, I think, with parents, they're tired and so that they don't have to cook and they can come right from work and they can play and eat with their kids and provide the structure for that.
Yeah.
That's
very good. And taking up, you say, like the responsibility for not just mm-hmm. our own biological children, but what a witness that what you just said about what you're doing in your church, or what these single people in the church were thinking about and trying to think about the youth. That's quite a wonderful, I think, testimony. Because I think it also relates to how we think about children. You know, do we think about children as sort of my property? Or there's a lot of interesting books about what are our attitudes really to children. And Herb Anderson, this guy, has written so much on show and says, we really basically have contempt for kids. Because if you look at our record, just on poverty, one out of five kids lives in poverty. Just that, not alone education, violence, all the rest. If you just look at that statistic, there must be something about us that we don't. We have kind of a contempt or indifference towards children. We treat them kind of as our own property or as a kind of commodity. Even in consumers, we see them as little consumers. So to have a lift up a different image, they're made in the image of God. So they're all, you know, we're all kind of have to take care of these kids around us. Ways to open us up theologically for concern for other children. That's very good and very important.
I think that another way of nurturing is to, we talked about this, but to share experiences. And that, what you talked about too, you know, when you gather with your dinner group friends.
Yeah.
You know, to be intentional about inviting the children to be with you.
Yes.
That invitation. They may say, no, I don't want to be a part of that. But to encourage them.
Yeah.
That invitation. And also to, when I say share experience, I think about coming up on the boat yesterday. There was a group of daughters, younger girls, women, and their mothers or friends, I didn't know the relation. They sat together and they talked.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such an incredible picture.
Yeah.
I mean, I noticed it enough to say something about it.
Yeah.
But if I just keep it and just notice it for myself, mm-hmm. and not share it, something's missing.
Right.
So that's what I mean, sharing that experience.
And that's very good. I think it goes along with that, you know, kind of conversation you have with kids and how it is so important to hear from other adults besides your parents. You know, that they take interest in you. We have a mentoring program in our church, and the confirmation kids just love this. You know, it's some other adult. And you see them probably once a month, something like that. You can make up your own routine. But they like it very much. These young people like somebody else taking an interest in them. And I think what you said also relates to this notion of, are we welcoming children? Do we have an attitude of welcoming children? Like, you know, the New Testament, Jesus is welcoming the child is really quite a startling kind of radical thing that he did. And how do we welcome children into the conversation or into the dinner or into the church, into the worship service? How do we do that? Is it Karen? Yeah.
I was going to comment. We have a 3-year confirmation program at our church, which has its strengths and weaknesses. But my favorite part of it is that our pastors developed confirmation homework where the kids have to read a passage of the Bible. Or, like last fall, we studied the Ten Commandments. And then he has a series of questions they have to reflect on. And the parents need to read it and sign off on it. And then they have to bring it back to church to show that their parents have read it. And I've had the best conversations with my 12-year-old based on his responses. And it's just a starting point that doesn't come up necessarily unless you're very diligent about devotions. I mean, when he comes home from school, I don't say, so what moral issue did you face?
Right.
A simple tool like that,
yeah,
where you have to read it and sign it, and then it's led to great discussions.
Yeah.
That's been a real positive thing in our house.
That's very good, and that's a very nice example of kind of a vital relationship where there are some things the church can do to just, you know, either provide resources or a few questions or build it into what they're doing so that the family participates in some way. You know, that's a wonderful way to do something like that.
Well, the downside is he's gotten a lot of criticism from parents for it because my kid has enough homework, why are you sending more? I think that's discouraging because I think it's very positive. And again, it takes time. Not every day, and your kid has to do it. So it's mixed.
Yeah.
In our church, it's a real mixed thing, but I think it's wonderful.
Well, that's very interesting, too. It makes you wonder, what do we think our main role is in our parenting? If it's seen as a, come on, he's got enough to do. He's doing all these other things. Then what is it we're saying all these other things should be doing? You know, what? And maybe that leads us back to what we want to help develop in our children.
It sounds like the church's mission is to educate the parents.
Yes. You know what one book said? What we need is kids to drop off their parents and then bring it home. this person wanted to solve this.
Well, if you're going to turn this, switch the paradigm, you just turn it around so that it's happening in the home. I mean, it's just not going to happen without the nurturing of the whole family.
Right.
And so what you're doing is...
Yeah, very good.
There are many programs that pull the adults into it, mm-hmm. specifically the parents. People who no longer have children at home,
right.
who are successful especially, are very helpful in that, can be.
Yeah.
Church has done a real injustice, I think, if a family does come to Sunday school, okay, the kids go here, adults go here.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
it just,
mm-hmm.
rather than retired folks have their meeting here.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why some churches is promoting intergenerational mm-hmm. Sunday school instruction. That's the way to go, to come together to something where we learn together.
You know, I wonder about the teaching part. If the way that I grew up is that it was more of to get the answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we understand faith, is that we find the answers, as opposed to the questions.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
to what are the questions?
Yeah.
What are your questions?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's very good. And treating children, I think this goes back to how we treat children. We don't really see them as people with questions. There's a wonderful movement within philosophy now. A guy, Garrett Matthews at Amherst, is doing this, where he talks about how we, you know, children are asking philosophical questions. We need to nurture that. He's real interested in philosophy and how you have that developed in the elementary and high schools. But really, it brings up this point. Children have tremendously important questions, even starting, especially, you know, early on, very early on. But he says, you really start seeing philosophers age 47. And then we kind of cut them off because we say, these aren't important questions. You've got to know just this answer, this answer. And Schleiermacher was one who said, this 19th century guy, he said, what we have to do, exactly what you're talking about, we have to treat children in our Sunday schools and confirmation as fellow seekers. We have to respect their questions. And that he felt the one thing that drives children away from church and they never come back is terrible confirmation experience. I've had that. My students have said, I don't know, it's the one. But Schleiermacher put a lot, he said, boy, it is an urgent task for your pastors, and it's probably the most important thing you do, and you got to put time into it. And it relates very much to what you were saying about treating them with respect and as fellow seekers, that they have genuine questions, and we need to help them articulate those questions.
I'd highly recommend Juicy Fruit Gum.
Now, what is that?
My intern over there last year brought me this big pack of Juicy Fruit Gum. Well, the children, little kids who come on Wednesday nights, started coming in for a stick of Juicy Fruit Gum. So it's become a tradition now. They kind of have to go through the ritual of, you know, knocking on the door and then asking. But it brings them into my office, it gets some questions going. So one little girl was having trouble with school with some of the big change came. I need to talk to Pastor. So she comes in and we have a conversation about what she was taking. But they know the Juicy Fruit's there. So it's just kind of a way of connecting with
and
you can develop a relationship with real little kids and maintain that. Then when their questions, I think, keep
coming, you have
the relationship. But it's amazing what that
Yeah, it's kind of showing the door is open. The door is open, and they can get in the habit of, this is my pastor, you know, and this is, I can come in the office anytime I want.
I think that story's great because I'm thinking the first time I was in our head pastor's office was when I had my confirmation interview, and we joined that church when I was five. You know, but that was always like, Josie's office.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so even though I ran, you know, terrorized the rest of the entire church, that was like the Holy of Holies. So that's really interesting. I like that idea a lot.
Mm-hmm. I think we have time for one more comment. Is there anyone else who'd like to add something? Oh, that's always hard when you say that they are very nice. Okay. Well, I thank you so much for your participation. I do have some resources up if you'd like to look through this catalog or look at some of this material. Thank you so much for your participation.